Hello everyone, this is Bruce Freed at Denton's. Welcome to our third session. We're getting a little feedback. We're good now. Our third discussion, conversation, crystal ball reading, although the crystal ball has gotten much clearer, at least for the moment. I'm here again today with my good friend and colleague, Jennifer Healy. This is Bruce Spreed. I'm a partner in the healthcare group at Denton's. Jen is in our public policy group, but she has the key to the healthcare group door as well. So, and during the last two sessions, we talked about the status, the state of play, if you will, for the House consideration of the American Healthcare Act. How interesting things are today. I am sure all of you watched with great interest and potentially surprise, astonishment at what was ultimately the decision by the Speaker and the President to withdraw the legislation from floor consideration, effectively ending the House's consideration and Congress's consideration of the AHCA as a vehicle to replace and repeal the Affordable Care Act. We're not going to spend a lot of time today talking about the political blow-by-blow, although it's hard not to wander into that territory. But Jen and I thought it would be at least of interest, maybe even useful, to talk about where do we go here, where does the Congress and the administration go forward with regard to healthcare policy, the challenges that do confront the Affordable Care Act, and other important healthcare issues that the federal government needs to be attending to. So having set that up, Jen, why don't you get us started?
Sure, absolutely. And as Bruce said, it's sort of hard not to talk about what's next without going into a little bit about what happened on Friday. And I agree with Bruce. I think there's a lot of different emotions. I'm sure many different sectors of the healthcare industry felt on Friday when the ultimate decision was made to pull the bill and to stop the effort. Overarching, what turns out the sort of the lines in the sand that we had discussed on previous webinars and had been fully discussed in the media and the press accounts turned out to be lines too far for leadership in the White House to pull the ends together. So the Medicaid non-expansion versus expansion Republican governors, the parts of the GOP conference that we're still living in a world where full repeal should be something that should be discussed, you know, many argue a non-reality filled world, versus those in the GOP conference that knew that repealing as much as of the ACA that they could was a successful political victory, you know, and a win for, as they saw, for their constituents back home. So the reality that those sort of divides couldn't be bridged with any sort of amount of deal making or arm twisting, I think, is what finally sunk the deal. And so you had, you know, the two sort of tranches of GOP conference that were withholding their support of the bill, and without the bill ever coming to the floor, you know, there's no way to know if sufficient arm twisting and the bright lights of the floor would have changed anything. I think some things that helped sort of those folks stay in their corners without sort of fear of some political consequences is the fact that there are the conservative outside groups that remained opposed to the bill. So you have the Club for Growth, the Heritage Foundation, and the Koch brothers even offering, letting Republican members know those that might vote against the bill, they would have sort of political money to help them in their district explain the reason why they were going against the bill and, as the White House thought, going against the president. You have a lot of sort of in the post-mortem analysis, you know, White House was in full sell mode. They were very much committed to the process of trying to get the votes. I think in the analysis over the weekend, some saw it as them being in sort of full DC cell mode for this last week and the last couple of weeks, but not necessarily taking the message back to the districts, making it more national, and wondering if that was something that they could have done and whether it would have made a difference. Ultimately, the White House seemed to put their energy in trying to cut a deal with the House Freedom Caucus, which is the far right of the far right in the House conference, which as they continued to make concessions and make changes to the bill without actually getting an agreement from them to support it, that further distanced the sort of moderate Republicans from the Tuesday group. And they got frustrated with sort of the leadership's constant negotiations with that caucus without any sort of assurances of supporting them, because every change the White House and leadership made for the Freedom Caucus would make it harder for them to vote for the bill and harder for them to justify it back in their district. There, you know, you had a lot of folks in the White House and the administration that come from that far-right brand of Republican. You have Vice President Pence, Secretary Price, OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, who was a member of the Freedom Caucus all of about 5 minutes ago, and Steve Bannon, who obviously has spent a lot of time in the press side of the world of the far-right, all trying hard to get conservatives on board. And I think you saw some folks sort of the night before the vote, when the White House sort of issued their ultimatum, saying that the vote on Friday was going to be the vote on repealing the Affordable Care Act. That you could either be with them or against them, but you weren't going to get another vote. There was no more negotiations. Negotiations had stopped. I think some folks saw that ultimatum as sort of being the best strategy option they had left. And had they brought the bill to the floor under the bright white lights of the House floor with everyone sort of looking at them and sort of getting that political moment of, you know, asking a Freedom Caucus member if they were going to cast a vote with Nancy Pelosi and Rosa DeLauro and some other far-left liberal members of the Democratic Party, if that was good, you know, letting them know that this was the only vote that they were going to get. That was sort of the political ultimatum that was issued from the White House on Thursday night. However, the decision to not ever put the bill on the floor sort of took the teeth out of what was that political ultimatum that some, I think, saw on Thursday night as a strategically good move for Republican leadership, and ultimately thought that it would be enough to twist the Freedom Caucus into voting for them and having that political pressure. And so it was an attempt to sort of change what the vote meant for the Freedom Caucus, sort of say, this is your chance, this is your only chance to vote to repeal parts of the ACA, take it or leave it, but it's your only one. But as what turned out to be ultimately the decision to not put it on the floor, that sort of bluff was never called. I think what you have in the postmortem from members of the House, you had Congressman Tom Cole, who's chairman of the Labor and Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee, on TV this morning, saying that his only regret was that a vote was never called on Friday to force members to publicly decide. There was some reports that Speaker Ryan had a meeting with the Freedom Caucus members, ahead of that Friday decision, and tried to get them to tell their vote on the record with the White House in the room, and the Freedom Caucus chair sort of was trying to protect them from having to individually make that decision. So you saw some attempts at the political arm twisting, but it seemed that the Freedom Caucus sort of out-navigated and out-maneuvered. I think where they go from here and what the White House is signaling of what this failed vote on, a failure to get to a vote on Friday means, the White House has been clear as mud, I think, a little bit, as to what they're going forward. The president's statement on Friday was, you know, this is, that was it, that was the one chance, we're now going to let Obamacare go forward, or as the president said, sort of continue to fail and wait for Democrats to sort of come back to the table and say they're willing to make changes. Mulvaney tried to, over the weekend, in some of his press encounters, tried to broaden the sort of blame game in the House Republican conference to broader than just the House, the Freedom Caucus, but to also include moderate GOP. But I think that is sort of seen as transparent a little bit from where he came from in the House. There's also a press report that says the White House is probably a little frustrated with the Freedom Caucus and feeling like they didn't negotiate in good faith. And so whether or not they will negotiate with them in the future, or maybe to Democrats in Congress, which could have implications on a couple of the next term must-dos that Congress faces, funding the federal government by the end of the month, raising the debt limit, that if they have to go to Democrats to get those votes, that's ultimately going to hurt the Freedom Caucus because those votes will be brought to the center and not to the far right. So the speaker said on Friday that it was obviously a disappointing decision. He also said that the ACA will be the law of the land for this foreseeable future. And I think what that means is sort of left for people to sort of question if they really are going to move on for the next 6 to 8 months when you've got real consequences of maybe that decision with the rates having to be filed here very shortly and insurers sort of sitting there wondering what changes may or may not be made. Just this afternoon in the White House briefing room, Sean Spicer was asked, you know, pretty unequivocally, is health reform dead? He said no, but sort of cited that the fact that, you know, the law is dying and that they're waiting to sort of see what happens next. I think an interesting question in this call for bipartisanship from the White House is that leading into the consideration of the bill on the floor on Friday, in the committee consideration, you had a lot of Democrats sort of in their public statements in committee and their comments during committee consideration sort of lament this not being a bipartisan process and sort of offering what they, I'm assuming at the time, saw as a futile offer that they would really like to be part of fixing the bill, but there doesn't need to be repealed and replaced. I think those comments on the record and made during committee consideration will be interesting to see how the Democrats decide to either continue down that road and make good on those statements that they offered, or if the political realities are such that they have to move far, very far back. I think, as Bruce sort of said, the more interesting questions is sort of what does that mean going forward? Obviously, the administration spent a lot of time talking about sort of bucket two, which was meant to follow after a successful vote in Congress to do a partial repeal bill with partial replace. Bucket two was meant to have HHS use that flexibility that was given within the ACA to the administration to help us, and they talked about this and described it as such, as to help smooth the transition from the sort of ACA system into a new sort of view of the healthcare system. I think an interesting question now is if the point is to try to drive Democrats to the table by sort of highlighting what the Republicans are saying are the flaws in the Affordable Care Act and the increase in premiums, how much leeway does Secretary Price maybe now have to do smooth transition administrative type of fixes? Is the going forward, the White House going to tell folks is that they do want a little bit of the reality of the ACA to set in order to help overcome this political congressional problem? In essence, has the game plan changed a little bit as far as the administration flexibility? For several healthcare industries, obviously there's a huge question as far as the cost-sharing subsidies. That is a large question mark. That the Republican Congress had sort of set forward in this bill on for the House on Friday, that they were going to fund those cost-sharing subsidies to, again, help with that market stabilization and give insurers a reason to stay into the market. Now the question is, that's a very large axe, if you will, that Republicans could take if the goal becomes to allow, you know, from the Republicans' point of view, ACA to meet what they see as their eventual fate. So does the calculation on the cost-sharing subsidies now change? I think you have some Republican senators that have come out since Friday saying that they want to work on bipartisan fixes. Chairman of the Senate Health Committee, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, right away came out and called for fixes to the exchanges and the individual market. Senator Corker put out a statement that he had a conversation with the president on Friday and remains committed to working on sort of solving some of these outstanding issues on the ACA. And interestingly enough, even Tim Kaine from Virginia stated that he was looking forward to having a bipartisan conversation within the Senate Health Committee as well to improve the health system, is how he phrased it. So not to fix the ACA, but to improve the health system.
Just a quick aside here, Jen, it strikes me without going too far afield that among the people who were most relieved that the House bill did not move forward has got to be Senator McConnell.
Oh, yeah.
I can only imagine that he, notwithstanding the brave face and commitment that he articulated, he knew that he was going to face all the challenges that were going to have been in the House,
yes.
Except even more so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this may fall into the fake news category, but it's having worked in this town for many, many, many years, I think that's fair speculation.
No, absolutely. I think with the reality that the divided lines between the caucus were obviously present in the Senate and obviously much more magnified in the fact that they were dealing on such a small, they had a very narrow window of senators that they could lose, and having as many of problems, if not more, it was definitely magnified. I think a lot of people in D.C. that know Senator McConnell, you know, were sort of saying you never bet against him. He has survived
certainly true
many, many things, but I think you're right in the fact that him not having to walk that plank is something that he is relieved to probably have.
And create the kinds of schisms the House now confronts on the Senate, given the other big objectives that this administration and the Congress are going to be pursuing.
Yep.
Tax reform,
yep.
Infrastructure, all of which are going to need a more cohesive legislative approach than the one we've just seen.
Yeah, yeah, and obviously the Supreme Court nominee is something he's facing right now, and having... Again, I don't think anyone would have bet against McConnell in figuring out a way to pull the rabbit out of his hat, but had it not worked in the Senate, leading into what they had, a Supreme Court nomination the next week, would have been a big shift in momentum for them in the Senate as well.
Let me bring the conversation back to what does the administration do? It's unclear to me, having seen the president talk about, okay, well, Obamacare will just fail on its own. On one hand, the administration certainly has the capability to put a thumb on the scale and not be helpful to having Obamacare continue to function even with its challenges. An example, of course, was the pullback that we saw the administration execute in terms of advertising and encouraging people to enroll in the most recent exchange enrollment period? Or do we see the administration looking for mechanisms by which within its authority, the administration can identify ways in which Obamacare could be made to work better?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've got any instincts on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question, and I think it's part of the conflicting messages of where their long-term game plan is going. Are they going to this game plan that they want to try to drive Democrats to the table, and so do they want ACA to become more, you know, quote-unquote painful? And that would then lead them to do less administratively to sort of make changes or smooth out the process? Or do they try to smooth the transition knowing that softening the ground and letting folks know that we can make changes to the ACA without the world falling apart is going to help them with their whip count with Republicans to say, hey, we made these five changes, we're softening the ground, we're changing the ACA, so now when you vote to actually repeal and replace, your constituents might be scared less because they've seen some of the tweaks that have been done administratively.
As we heard when the Denton's public policy team met this morning, some of our very well-connected colleagues reported conversations this weekend among various people from the House, from the Senate, even from the administration that are beginning to talk about an ACA repair and repeal,
mm-hmm.
carefully putting those words in that order, strategy, early point in the conversation. So perhaps the administration, the leadership, and the Congress will want to come back and revisit the ACA issue. But we know that there are other health care issues that are coming at us very quickly, the reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program. How does all of this affect that?
No, it's a great question, because I think there were some goals for things to include on the CHIP reauthorization bill, dealing with sort of the Medicaid expansion and changes in those that are obviously not needed, because they never got to the Medicaid expansion. I think to answer your also a little bit more fully on your administration question, some of the things in the bill on Friday technically could be done by the administration. One of the things on zeroing out the mandates. The bill in the House that was going to consider wasn't to repeal the individual mandate. They made the fine go to zero. Well, that's something that the administration can do. The reason why the House was doing it was sort of for the budget rules and to get that money, to get credit for that money legislatively to help them put the reconciliation bill together. But if they're not going to be doing this through reconciliation anymore, they can look at, what kind of flexibility can we have on the mandates.
But if they were to do that, if the fine for not purchasing coverage goes to zero, wouldn't that then undermine having young people participate in the program, further skewing the risk pool in a way that will make the cost of coverage more expensive and actually undermining the exchanges?
Well, yeah, so in the bill, they had an alternative to the individual mandate they included, right? So what could they do administratively to do exactly what you're saying? If they get rid of the individual mandates or the employer mandates, what can they do administratively to try to make the plans attractive to the young and healthy? There's some I think they can do through regulation on reducing some of the age band rating. There was one draft regulation that went through that the law says 3-to-1. Technically, some were arguing, well, you can make it 3.49-to-1 administratively, and that doesn't run afoul of the statute. Obviously, that's not as much of a relief as the 5-to-1 change they were trying to do on the bill on the floor. But some of those changes that they might be looking at doing, what can they do with the essential health benefits administratively, which, you know, on Republican side of the aisle, they argue drives up the cost of health care. So if you can bring some flexibility to those plans that drive the cost of those plans down, that can make it more attractive to the young and healthy, and you don't maybe need, in theory, the mandate. So I think there are sort of differences in what kind of administrative relief they can do that can either be seen, as you point out, something could be seen as, well, that's trying to help aid the transition, but it also has a flip side that says, well, that could actually undermine the market too. So it's a yin and a yang for sure of how to go through that. But on your CHIP reauthorization, I think most folks had saw that some of the Medicaid flexibility that they couldn't put through the reconciliation bill because of the budget rules would sort of take a ride on the CHIP reauthorization. Do they still do that, even though they never got the Medicaid expansion, or do they let the CMS administratively do as much flexibility as they can within the Medicaid program? Do they try to put in some kind of work requirement that's allowed within the confines of the administrative regulatory body? Do they try to work on getting more waivers to states? They're in the ACA, there is a 1332 waiver that allows states to basically apply for a waiver from the ACA. In the Obamacare or in the Obama administration, obviously they weren't that excited about granting those kind of waivers. But they, in a Trump administration, maybe they make those easier for states to apply for and get. You also have the FDA user fee reauthorizations this year. They are making their way through Congress now. FDA has sort of signed their agreement with the drug industry, and Congress is beginning their contemplation. The Senate and House have had their committee, had hearings last week. The House Energy and Commerce has a hearing this week on medical device user fees, so obviously that's going to continue going through Congress. I think the big question mark people wonder on the user fee conversation in Congress is in the president's sort of skinny budget, they talked about wanting to double the amount that private pharma pays into the reauthorization, into the user fee, which is sort of a, you know, after the deal has been signed it's sort of not normal to go back and reopen those kind of conversations. But in the sort of political reality of where drug pricing is, does what the president put on his budget catch any steam within Congress? Last week, the House Oversight Committee had a hearing talking about sort of pharmaceutical supply chains and meant to sort of dig into a question of whether or not some of those practices have any impact on sort of this drug, broader drug pricing argument. And then you've got tax reform coming up, right? The president has been sort of saying in every press statement he could that, you know, he really can't wait to get to tax reform, and that's really what he cares about. And that's going to have to go through reconciliation as well. So you have another vehicle with a simple majority-only vote. Do they try to put some of these healthcare changes into the tax reconciliation package? I mean, that whip count is probably hard enough just on getting tax over the finish line. I don't know if there's room for healthcare, but I think a lot of people had originally thought the tax credit, like repeal and replace of the ACA from the current premium subsidies to the sort of a refundable and advanceable tax credit, were going to take place in tax reconciliation, and they got expedited into the health reconciliation, ironically, because members wanted to do more of than just a repeal vote. They wanted a repeal and replace vote. So leadership sort of expedited that, but, you know, that vehicle is still going to be out there. And then the other sort of administrative thing going forward is there's still MACRA implementation going forward, sort of the continued sort of shift from paying for volume to paying for value. There's a very bipartisan Congress concept in Congress. You know, you're going to see HHS continuing with that sort of momentum. And I know so many players in the healthcare industry are sort of engaged in that broader conversation, both out from outside the government, what they can do within their own sphere of influence, and ways that they run their institutions and organizations, to sort of what the decisions the government makes on it. So I think that is something you can look forward as well.
So that was a tour de force. very well done. In the last couple of minutes, let's just step back and think about who benefited, in a sense, from the collapse of the AHCA legislation.
Who's relieved?
not just who's relieved, but what sectors of the healthcare community had expressed a great concern?
Yeah.
Hospitals, for sure. We know that the AHA and FAH had commissioned an economic analysis that had suggested the loss of $165 billion over 10 years. I can tell you I spent time this weekend with one of the executives of one of the major hospital associations, and the first words out of his mouth was, what a relief.
Mm-hmm.
So hospitals, number one, particularly those that had any exposure on the Medicaid side, mm-hmm. or for people who are getting coverage through exchanges, they've dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
For health plans that serve the Medicaid community,
mm-hmm.
I think they're all breathing more easily today. In the days prior to the withdrawal of the bill, we saw a number of senior executives from Medicaid health plans talk about the devastation that their industry would confront. So I think they're relieved. It's going to be interesting to see of the states that had chosen to not take advantage of Medicaid expansion, how many of them will now revisit that decision?
Kansas literally right now is voting to do that. So they, you know, talking to some of the Kansas members of Congress here, the one change to the House bill was that they put a date of March 1st, 2017, that states, if they had expanded prior to that, and a lot of folks in Kansas felt that they were very much targeted for that because their state legislature is currently through the process of deciding to expand. And so I think you will see a few folks, a few states now take folks up on that offer.
Which would make sense, particularly given the expertise that the CMS Administrator, Seema Verma, brings with her deep involvement in counseling largely Republican states mm-hmm. in how to reform their Medicaid programs. I think all of this is an indicator of the direction we'll see.
Yeah,
and finally, I think with a return to some sense of, quote, normalcy, with the removal of the uncertainty and consequent instability for healthcare decision makers, publicly traded, nonprofit, for-profit, the return to the system that we know, with all of its warts and pimples, I think offers the healthcare industry widely an ability to think forward a little bit more, even recognizing we may be back at some point to revisit some of this. It will be in a hopefully more bite-sized series of chunks as opposed to swallowing the entire elephant in one gulp.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, listen, with that, any final thoughts?
No, I think it'll be, I think some of the tea leaves to read is within just even this week is to see what statements come out of the White House and sort of congressional leadership, Republican leadership. Are they sticking with the, this is the one shot and we're done and ACA is the law of the land for the foreseeable future? Do they stick with that? Or do they let some of these members that are trying to display that they could be the ones to bring the two factions of the Republican Party together and come up with, you know, Jim Jordan, head of one of the other conservative caucuses in the House, has said, you know, it's really upon us and the moderates to come together and make a decision and forge a way forward. Well, that doesn't matter if leadership's not going to let you have time on the floor to do it. And, you know, really in the power struggle that is everything in Washington, D.C., you know, if you make an ultimatum of putting a bill on the floor and you don't do it, and then you make an ultimatum that the consequences for those folks of blocking that are they're going to have to live with the reality of the ACA's the law of the land for a little bit further, and then you let them back in the door with maybe coming up with a different kind of a compromise. It's just, I think, in that ultimate power struggle of leadership versus the rank and file, it would be hard to sort of see them walk that back. But I think that'll be interesting to see is what are those talking points coming out of both the White House and congressional leadership as to are they really turning the page? Are they really only talking about funding the federal government? Are they really only talking about the debt limit and tax reform? Or are they letting health care creep back into the conversation?
Jen, thanks very much. For those of you still with us on the phone, we thank you for the time you've spent with us. We hope that it has been helpful to you. It would be helpful to us to receive any comments you'd like to offer. Is this sort of webinar helpful to you as you think about the implications of significant healthcare policy changes to your organization? For the time being, I think this is the last of the webinars that we will do on this topic.
Yes.
But as the opportunity and need presents itself, we will be speaking with you again. Until then, thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye.